The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Classically, in Buddhism, there is a very important distinction that much of classic Buddhism kind of rests on. And I'm going to use two words to describe this distinction, which are a little bit slightly unconventional, but I think allowable, just a little different translation of the terms. And the distinction is between the realm of our life, which is relational, and the realm which is non-relational. So they're relational and non-relational. And the Buddhist analysis of human life is that much of human life is relational. You know, most of everything we do and concern ourselves with belongs to this relational realm. And so certainly something as basic as our physical upkeep of our body and ourselves belongs to that relational realm, because we have to relate to the food we get, the foods we grow, the relationship, our work that makes it all possible, the people we work with, exchanges, and you know, it's a huge relational world we live in. And then for many people, then our social life is very important for us. And so our social life predominantly, or maybe entirely, belongs to this relational world as well. It concerns how we relate to people, what our relationships are to people, and how people relate to us. And people can spend a lot of time building up personas, building up strategies, building up a whole sense of who they are in this world based on what happens in the relational field, social relational field. And there are influences that happen to us as children, for example, that have a big impact on how we understand ourselves. Based on how people relate to us, we then understand who we are. Based on how we understand ourselves, we then relate back to other people. They then see us in a certain way, they relate back to us. And there's this endless feedback loop where we kind of understand who we are in relationship to other people and other and the world and everything. Some of this relational world is comes with a lot of suffering. And some of it is quite beautiful and very inspiring, very lofty. The suffering part, you know, is that sometimes the world, the physical world, doesn't cooperate with what we want. And so there's all kinds of natural disasters that might happen. Earthquake, San Andreas Fault decides to move on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. And suddenly we have a new event. Or fires we had here in California this summer. This afternoon I'm driving down to Tassajara in the Los Padres National Wilderness, where they had this huge forest fire this summer. And right in the middle of it, in its little oasis, is Tassajara, the Zen monastery. So I'm going to go. That was saved through a lot of heroism. And so I'm going to go down there today and see what, you know, see this little oasis of green in the midst of this charred landscape. And so Buddhism doesn't tire by saying, you know, that this world that we build our life on, even the world necessarily build our life on, is a relatively unstable world. So the Buddhist attitude when this world doesn't provide us with what we want, what we need, is to be not surprised. Because often people are surprised, what? you know, it doesn't work. The telephone system broke down, doesn't work, there's no electricity, what? How can that be? And the Buddhist approach would be, well, what do you expect? You know, there's a level of instability in all this as well. And so it's often been commented that the Buddhists in Asia sometimes have a much lighter attitude towards things not working out, because there's kind of built-in expectation that things are unstable, impermanent, things are passing. And then the social world also is, you know, if we the relational world there is also wrought with potential suffering. And I think every single one of you has suffered in that social realm. Both in the recipient, people have caused you suffering, and also you probably caused your share, a fair share of suffering to others. Maybe you have to think back until teenagehood to remember But you know, there's been, you know, we've said things and done things that we wish we wouldn't have done. And also there in the social realm, human beings are unstable. We get sick, we get old, and we die. And so if we depend on the relational world being a certain way, then the suffering we feel, the distress, discomfort, the sadness we feel, is much greater if we depend on it. So Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on understanding the way in which dependency, psychological dependency, will augment and increase the level of suffering that we have in this changing world. So if we depend on the relational world to always be a certain way, then or have expectations built into it, then we're set up for relatively easy suffering because the relational world will change so much. And then there's really dysfunctional relationships to the relational world. And it doesn't take a lot of self-understanding to see how much the human mind is primarily preoccupied with the relational world. And whenever there's a want, we want something. That wanting means that you're in relationship to something, in relationship with what you want. So whether you want something to be a certain way, or you want to have something, or you want something to go away, that involves being in a relationship with something. And someone, if you watch your mind, what your thoughts are and your emotions, you'll see that a lot of human thought and has a quality of intentionality or wishes or wanting behind it or fueling it. And to a great degree, wanting is the engine which drives much of the human mind. Meditators can see that, I think, much more clearly than people who don't meditate, because we sit down to meditate and try to be still, focus on the breath, for example, and we see how hard it is because the mind has this very powerful compulsion or drive to think. And then you look at what's, you know, so there's almost like a desire to think. And so right there, there's a relationship to thinking. And then the content of the thought or the motivations of the very thoughts often have to do with wanting something. It's somewhat embarrassing for many of us to realize how many of our thoughts are self-preoccupying. And so wanting something for ourselves, wanting to look better or have something or, you know, something all related to ourselves. So the relational world in the Buddhist analysis is where most people live most of the time, where their thoughts are, their concerns are. And it isn't just the external world that we relate to. It's also the internal world, ourselves. We relate to ourselves. We have a relationship to ourselves, which, you know, in some ways is healthy. You're supposed to have some kind of healthy relationship to yourself. But it can also be dysfunctional, where we're just completely preoccupied with ourselves. Some people have very little awareness of their relationship to the world outside because they're so caught up in the relationship to themselves. Narcissism, for example. And so the way they negotiate the world is primarily through having a relationship to themselves. You know, they have a certain attitude and understanding of who they are. And, you know, it's the relationship we have. Classically, we talk about people who have a victim mentality, or the people who might feel that they're narcissistic, they're special, they're the center of attention. Everything should revolve around them. And so, you know, we have a certain relationship that towards ourselves then becomes the primary mode through which we relate to others, sometimes not very well because of that. So the relationship is in all directions. And even some people who seemingly have no relationship to much outside of themselves, there's a very powerful relationship to this inner life, inner world. So there's certainly dysfunctional ways in which this works. So I said that there's, first of all, that the relational world is unstable, and so to depend on it in any kind of way is going to cause suffering. And also there are dysfunctional relationships to that relational world, which, you know, cause a lot of difficulties. But there's also functional or healthy relationship to the relational world. And so Buddhism, a lot of Buddhist teachings has to do about how to create a healthy relation to the relational world, how to live in that world well. So something as basic as living ethically, practicing generosity, which are so fundamental to Buddhism, has to do with how to live wisely in the relational world. If you want to have healthy relationships to yourself and to others, practice generosity, practice ethics. The very, very important practice in Buddhism of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and sympathetic joy have to do with the relational world, and it's creating an attitude and approach which is considered the optimal for living in the relational world with other people. So cultivating kindness. If you're going to relate to other people, spend some time figuring out how to do that in a kind way, as opposed to, you know, some of the other unfortunate alternatives. So Buddhism puts a lot of teaching in Buddhism is about this relational world, taking care of it. And a lot of the spiritual maturity in Buddhism has to do with developing this relational world. At the upper reaches of the healthy relational world, there are some really powerful experiences that can happen. Some of them we call the mystical experiences. So for example, there can be experience of oneness with the universe or oneness with, for example, a sense of tremendous unity. Everything seems unified. Or there can be a tremendously powerful sense of love that just seems to be bigger than any individual relationship. And these kinds of experiences of unity, of oneness, of non-dualism, of infinite love and all that, are celebrated and beautiful, very powerful. They're so powerful that some people will take them as being ultimate. This is what it's all about. This is the whole pinnacle of the spiritual life, is to have these kinds of attainments. Buddhism would classify those kinds of attainments within the relational world itself. And even though they can be life-transforming and seem very ultimate and, be very, very significant, no way we want to diminish their importance, they still belong to the relational world. Here, especially here in the modern West, one kind of pinnacle of this relational world is the very powerful experience that people can have of being, of living in an interdependent world, where we're all kind of living in the sense of interdependence and how everything is just connected to everything else. For some people, especially here in the West, in the modern world, is often seen as being a very, very significant, inspiring understanding and realization. People go up in the Sierras, go backpacking, go by the ocean, do something, just feel, wow, we're all connected, we're all interrelated. I seem to almost disappear in this kind of interrelated world, and it's very beautiful. I had one of my early experiences like this that was quite moving for me was in my taking a botany class in college at UC Davis. And studying, very intently involved in the professor talking about the oxygen, carbon dioxide cycle for plants and how it all works. I remember having this big diagram on the chalkboard of, all how it worked. And so I was involved in that lecture. And then I left that lecture and went out into the courtyard, the beautiful big trees they have at the campus there. And I just was stunned and stopped. I literally stopped in my tracks and just looked at the trees. And I had this very powerful question or sense of how my ability to live was dependent on these trees or plants producing oxygen. And my life, more than, I could do away with a kidney or one eye or all kinds of things, one arm, all kinds of parts of my body I could do without, but I couldn't do without these plants out there in the world. My life was more dependent on that than some things that I thought were quite, quite important here. And so I just stood there for a long time, just in awe of this interdependent world we live in. Some people will see this interdependent world as quite sacred. And I'm kind of inclined to see it that way as well. I think it's a beautiful, sacred kind of thing, this world. And I love it that just here, just close by here, we have above the Crystal Springs Reservoir, we have this, San Francisco has this kind of watershed land up there that is basically humans are not supposed to go to. And now, in the last few years ago, they now have some few guided hikes to go through, but for years, no one could go there at all. And I loved it that there was a big swath of land that no human being was allowed to touch. For me, that made it kind of sacred, as opposed to us being everywhere. Something that's kind of outside of our domain, the human domain. So this interdependent world can be seen as sacred. It's a very kind of, I think it's beautiful, very, very, very profound and very important realization for people to have in this world that becomes increasingly interdependent, and to see it as kind of sacred. Classically in Buddhism, before there was kind of the tragedy of the commons, before there was a sort of sense of the tremendous damage we can do to the environment and to ourselves as a result. The sense of the interdependent world was not seen as a solution, but rather was representative part of the problem of human life. The fact that we're so interdependent means that we're caught in the world of potential suffering. And so, for example, we can have a romantic relationship with this interdependent natural world. And I was just at Yosemite, where the rangers up there made this point very clear. They had these videos about bears. And they had this beautiful kind of, in the video, beautiful kind of display of teddy bears. And how cute teddy bears are, and lovely, and all that. And then they showed the real bears. And they showed how dangerous they could be. And said, please be careful. These are not to be cuddled. You know, in fact, that they should be respected. You know. And so, you know, there are certain animals around that would be quite happy to participate in the interdependent world by eating you. And the interdependent world is quite beautiful and inspiring when you go up in the Sierras in the winter or even in the summer, for example. You go up in the summer. I was up there one place on Tuolumne just now, and I was a little bit surprised that we hiked very far up Tuolumne Meadows to Soto Springs. And there's this old Sierra Club building that's still there. And there was a ranger inside, and it was a beautiful sunny day, stone building. And at the bottom end of the stone building, there was a fire, big fireplace. And I thought, oh yeah, because in the winter it's cold here. And in the fireplace, there was a huge pile of logs built up, just ready to make a fire. And the ranger said that there can be, in the summertime, there can be these sudden storms that can arrive pretty much out of nowhere. And it can get very, very cold very quickly, and there can be hail. And so we have this place here, people can run for shelter, and because people get hypothermia very easily, we'd light this fire very quickly. So that makes the interdependent world very nice when you have a fire and a building and all that, and you're well-dressed. But go out into the Sierras without proper dress, and this interdependent world can be your end very quickly. So classically in Buddhism, the sense of interdependent world was more a world of danger than it was of inspiration the way it is now. And like, I'm very inspired by the sense of interdependence. It's very meaningful for me in my relationship to the world to understand that. So I don't want to belittle that any kind of way. But it's been pointed out that in the history of Buddhism, the people who most emphasize interdependence, the interdependent world, as being a beautiful sacred world, have been the upper class, middle-upper class people. Isn't that interesting? Makes you wonder a little bit about it. Those people who are comfortable in this world, they're the ones who can really celebrate how wonderful interdependence is. So, the relational world. We live in the relational world. And so many people, their relational world is very much centered around what I call the relational self. They have an understanding of who they are, and who they are is relational. And so it's all about negotiating that relational self. What I want, what I should get, how people relate to me, how I want to relate to other people, how I'm going to be safe, how I'm going to get what I want. I'm this way, I'm that way, this is the identity I want to have, this is the identity I have, which is unfortunate. And so it's all about the relational world. I'm going on and on, partly with a little bit of the motivation to start getting you tired out by the relational world. And because, again, classically in Buddhism, there comes a point in Buddhist spirituality where there's a very healthy, meant to be healthy, getting kind of a little bit tired of only living in the relational world. And it makes some sense to be tired in it because it's exhausting. The relational world requires being in relationship. And being in relationship is an activity, is a doing. And so you can see, if you sit down to try to quiet your mind in meditation, you see the mind is sometimes spinning, wanting to be in relationship, this and that. And it's, you know, it's kind of tiring. Most people don't see how tiring it is because they're so caught up and they're blinded by the activity and desires from seeing that it's actually stressful to be involved in this kind of activity all the time. So, then Buddhism then has this other side of the distinction, and that is the non-relational realm. There's a non-relational way of being here in this world. And that's both a strategy in meditation, for example, to begin not relating to things, and also it eventually becomes experience of liberation or freedom, to rest in this non-relational experience, to have the mind not relating all the time, but that the mind, in a sense, may be resting in itself. So the busy activity of doing has come to a stop. So liberation in Buddhism is sometimes called a stopping, kind of a very radical stopping. At this juncture in a discussion, some people are ready to leave. You know, what? Stopping the relational, stepping outside of the relational world? Why would I want to leave the relational world? That's all I know. That's what it's all about. That's what I want. And this is kind of frightening or disturbing or, this non-relational world, what good does it do? Is it going to get me a better partner, a better job? Is it going to make me healthier? I'm sick and I need to get well. And the non-relational world, what's that to do with, my health? Some people kind of then shy away from it. They want to reject it entirely. So as a strategy and practice, for people who are always doing, it's very powerful sometimes to do a practice we don't do, or try not to do, to do the not doing. And even though it's kind of a doing to not do for a while, and you could say, well, this is a paradox and I'm stuck and I'm trapped. Don't worry about that. It's just, if you try not to do, and in doing not doing, you do 99% less doing than you usually do. It is very powerful because it pulls the rug from underneath the edifice, the constructions that we build of the doing world that we hold in place. And so it's not a very complicated thing to do, at least in theory, and that is to sit down, close your eyes, and do something like just follow the breath. And no matter what arises in your mind, to think about anything, to be concerned about anything, to get involved in anything in your mind, don't. Just go stay with your breath. Come back to your breath. Really important, really consequential things arise. Really important things, like to say that when people sit and meditate, that when I was a new meditator, really important things would happen that I had to take care of right away during the meditation, like defrosting the freezer. So nowadays I can have defrost a freezer now kind of thoughts in meditation, and I just let go. Okay, come back. Don't do that one. That's okay. Don't do that one. And but it gets more subtle, of course. You start thinking about planning. What you're going to do for the rest of the day, and so I'm not going to plan. Just go back. And so you start thinking about, what does someone think about me? Back. Or thoughts might be, I am a horrible person. And then you start thinking about all the reasons and rationale for why you're such a horrible person. That's a doing, right? So you come back to the breath. I like to think of this as an umbrella. You carry the umbrella and the rain just falls off the umbrella freely. And so you kind of use the breath, for example, or something like it. And if you can, let everything else kind of be like the rain just falls off. The rain's welcome to come if you have the umbrella. So you have the breath, and that's your wonderful umbrella. You just let things be. You can have horrible thoughts. You can have saintly thoughts. It doesn't matter what kind of or feelings you have, emotions you have. What's beautiful about this approach is you're allowed to have whatever feelings, whatever thoughts, whatever comes up for you. It's okay. Because if it's not okay with you, then you're caught in the relational world. Then you're the doing. Oh, it's not okay. It's all okay. You let it be. And just come back to the breath. Very, very simple. I mean, simple in theory. And what happens to many people when they do this is that relational world, that the world of doing, begins to settle down, begins to relax. Because in part, the doing world, the relational world, feeds on itself. And the more we do, the more we try to be in relationship, the more we feed that concern, preoccupation, and it goes on and on and on without any stop. If we just kind of, as a strategy in practice, begin just let go of that, it's really remarkable what can happen. Because a lot of the tension, a lot of the stress we hold in our body, all this tension and stress in our body, the inner body, belongs to the relational world. It comes from being in relationship. So people calm down, the mind gets quieter and stiller, the body gets quieter and stiller, and we start getting a perspective or see a difference between degrees of being caught in the relational world. And so at first the person might not experience the non-relational world, but they see there's there are degrees of difference. They see, wow, if I work 75 hours a week, always motivated and concerned with trying to be, promotion or money or whatever, now that I meditate, I see how stressful it was to always be involved in that kind of intense relational world. So I'm going to do something much more, I'm going to let go of that. And some people then choose a much more peaceful or happier relational world to be in. They go hiking in the Sierras, or wow, nature is great or whatever. They take up stamp collecting or something. And so it's a matter of degree, and that change of degree can show you how to live in a much more healthy, wiser way in this world. So as we calm down and settle down, we have access to a whole different way of being in this world. A deeper sense of well-being from a very hopefully a simpler, healthier relationship to the world. It's also pointed out that as the heart and the mind gets calmer and stiller, that there are deeper wellsprings of emotions and insight and understanding about this world of ours that can come from that. The person who's working 75 hours a week intensely is probably not going to have much access to compassion, probably not going to have much access to deeper wellsprings of intuition or insight about themselves and their life, or capacities of empathy, or to be able to listen to the deeper kind of intentions, wishes, understandings that might exist in the more quieter parts of the mind. So as people do this less and less doing, they have access to a much richer world than if we're caught up in the doing and relationship all the time. So as the mind quiets down, gets stiller, then it's almost as if people at some point begin seeing that there's an alternative from always being involved in doing. Even when the doing is peaceful and calm and lovely and feels good, there's an alternative to that as well. And that is for the mind to stop doing entirely. And so some people then will talk about awareness. Awareness by itself has no stress or tension in it. Awareness by itself has no doing inherent in it. Awareness by itself, some people will say that's it. Some people will see that that something like awareness or presence or sense of being also seems to have very little self in there. It gives up the relational self to self. And so they say, then they think, well, that's the real self. The non-relational self is the real self. But as long as we relate to something as the self, we're still relating. So what is it like to have this non-relational place of rest or peace if you can't relate to it? If you can't relate to it and make it into something that's good for you, myself, my ego, my identity. And it defies, that non-relational place defies clinging, defies too much definition, defines something you want to hold on to, make an identity out of. Because as soon as you make an identity out of it, you're relating to it and you're back in the relational world. You're relating to that thing. It's a little bit irritating because it's kind of like trying to grab your elbow. Right elbow with your right hand. You just can't quite, you have an elbow there, but you just can't, you can't just kind of, get to it. Or you're in the dark, right, and you can't see it, can't use your eyes. How do you know you have an elbow? All you have is a right arm. You go around, you try. So this non-relational place is kind of like that. So sometimes I call it the non-relational self. But you have to kind of hold that idea very lightly, because you know, there's no, you can't relate the self to it in any kind of way. But I find it useful to distinguish between the relational self and this provisional idea of the non-relational self. All that some people know is the relational self. That's all they know. If that's all a person knows, then, of course, there's good logic behind trying to protect and fix and enhance our life by negotiating the relational world. Negotiating the relational world. Fixing the relational world, getting to be just right. To highlight, I mean, it's valuable to do that to a certain degree. We have to do that. But to highlight, from the point of view of the non-relational world, I like to highlight that our efforts to fix the relational world to be just right, it's kind of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's going down anyway. The relational world is going down. Suzuki Roshi said, the Zen master said, life is like getting into a boat that's going to go out to sea and sink. Well. So much for this Buddhism stuff. I mean, you can go down the street to much more inspiring spiritual worlds where you can be, you know, sometimes I think, you know, it's very hard to be a Buddhist because it's easier to be practice spirituality where you have this very deep relationship to something. So a relationship to God is pretty good, right? So it's much more inspiring to be in relationship because the relational part of us really wants to be related, right? And so Buddhism doesn't have a God to relate to that kind of way. So it's, you know, it's harder in many ways. And then you can hear that this very powerful place of awakening, you can't have a relationship to it. Or you can, of course, have a relationship to it. But the point is not to have a relationship to it. The point is to wake up and rest there, to be there. And then someone might ask, you know, what good is it? And then I would say that to have some sense or an experience of the non-relational world is very, very powerful because then you know there's an alternative. And then you're not going to put all your efforts into only fixing the relational world. And depending on that, you know there's a whole other game in town. And if there's another game in town, then you don't have to play just that one game. And so it's like when I'm with my children. Sometimes, you know, if I get pulled into their logic, there's no end. You know, I'm trapped. I'm caught. But if I kind of change the game, then, you know, it becomes much more harmonious. So they say, you know, I want ice cream right now. And then the ice cream came from a cow. I wonder what that cow's name was. What's a good cow's name? What would be the best name for a cow? And pretty soon they forget about wanting ice cream. So you change the game, right? So it's very healthy, I think. I apologize for such a simplistic example, but it's very healthy to know there's another game in town besides the relational game. And so that's one of the powerful things about Buddhist practice. Ultimately, Buddhist practice is pointing us back to this profound sense of well-being, of happiness, of peace, of liberation that belongs to this non-relational realm. Because it gives us, it have confidence in that and be rested in that, then it allows us to go back into the relational world with much more confidence and freedom. And so many people have pointed out, for example, that intimate relationships can work a lot better if they're not, there's no dependency as part of that relationship. If people are willing to be independent in a certain kind of way and not need each other, then it's actually possible to meet each other in a more deeper, intimate way. And that's counterintuitive because if we need someone, depend on them, then we want to, you know, then kind of want to hold on even more. But to be told, oh, if you let go more fully, then you can have a healthier relationship. That's a little bit counterintuitive or frightening for some people. So the whole relationship to the relational world, I think, becomes much healthier if we understand or rest or can build it on the non-relational. And the last thing I'll say is that there's a long tradition in Buddhism that the non-relational place in our hearts is the wellspring of compassion. which is relational. And that in Buddhism is considered to be one of the most ultimate, the combination of those two, liberation and compassion. Non-relational and the relational. The non-relational is freedom, the relational is informed or founded or based on compassion. The two go hand in hand, and you get to have both. Isn't that good? So I hope that made sense. The Pali word for the for relational, non-relational that I was trying to use is, those of you know, is sankara and asankara, sankata and asankata, samskara and asamskara. So thank you very much. And we have 4 minutes before our official ending time. We can relate a little bit now. Yes, please.
I liked your example with the cow, but you apologized for the simplicity of it and then moved on to the adult relationships we have.
Yeah.
About them. And it's really, especially the romantic partners that we need, and that meeting makes those relationships more difficult. So how would you do that with me as an adult? If I say instead of I want ice cream, I want a relationship. How do I get out of the needing of that in order to get to that healthier place of life?
I don't know, but maybe I would say to you, I'm curious, can you tell me, what's the deepest form of happiness and well-being that you've ever had in your life? Do you remember back?
Two answers come to mind. Mm-hmm. One is almost the sense I have of just being here right now is asking that question. And another is something that I've never quite gotten but always wanted. Which I think is exactly the point. The happiness that I think is there in a relationship. Mm-hmm. The happiness that I imagine. I can't really say, oh, it's this moment with my parents, or this moment with a lover, or this. It was always something that wasn't quite there.
So your life is based on imagination, imaginary possibility, which you've never actually, there's no proof that you'll ever have it, or that it exists. So you're chasing after a rainbow, maybe. But you've had some sense of happiness right now, just being, that wasn't so relationally based. So you asked me how it changed the game, so we changed it. Now we can start talking more about what's nature, you know, tell me more, you know, we won't do it now, but I would say, could you tell me more about what it feels like, what it's like, that sense of being, and what that happiness is like, and when in your life do you feel that the most, what are things that support it? And on we go, and if we do this well, after 10 minutes, you won't be thinking anymore about it, her or him that you're chasing. Yes, please.
You started out by saying this distinction that you're making, relational and non-relational, is a slightly different translation than we usually hear. So I'm just curious, what are the usual terms that are used for this distinction, and is it the same distinction as, I read sometimes these Zen teachers talk about the absolute and the relative? Uh-huh. Is it the same as that or not?
So the usual way in English is to call it the conditioned and the unconditioned. That world which is conditioned comes together because causes and conditions are there. So in relationship, and that which is unconditioned. Sometimes people have used the constructed and the unconstructed. That which is, comes together because it's constructed. So relationships are all constructed. And that which is unconstructed. And is it the same thing as the absolute and relative? There are certainly people who would say that. And Buddhists who would say, yes, that's exactly it. I'm a little bit shy about saying that because I feel I'm very shy, very hesitant about using the language of relative and absolute. The Buddha didn't use it and himself. And I think it kind of opens up a can of worms of problems that doesn't have to be there. So, for example, it seems in the history of Buddhism, the idea of relative and absolute arose in part because at some point Buddhists claimed that the Buddha taught that there's no self. And if there's no self, then how do you explain the self we have here? Oh, well, there's relative self and there's absolute, there's no self. However, the Buddha never taught that there's no self. So he didn't have to solve that problem. So it's a philosophical... So I think it opens up all kinds of problems that develop down through history and Buddhism. So I'm kind of shy about using it myself. One more. Yes.
In view of the teaching today, would you equate the on-relational aspect to be equivalent to the on-manifested and the deathless?
Yeah, more or less. Especially the deathless. I like that word a lot. That's what it says up there. Up there on the wall it says the deathless realm. That's what it literally says. And for me that's a synonym for this, for the experience of awakening or liberation, Nibbana.
I see. Thank you.
Oh, we have one more? No? Okay, well, this will be the last one. Some of you have relationships to your bladder that need to take precedence.
I'm remembering one time something that Shaila said, and it stayed with me for a long time, and it came up while you were speaking. She said, relationship creates separation. I've worked on that one for a while.
But it's true. Relationship creates separation, but even non-separation is to be in the relational world. So again, one of the ultimate kind of experiences in the relational world is a sense of no separation. And people will make that ultimate. But even the idea of no separation, in a very subtle way, belongs to the relational world. Wow, you know, there's no separation between me and you. But, you know, it's still... So the idea of non-separation is very powerful, very, very important kind of experience that some people have. And the non-relational realm is something entirely different beyond that. Okay. I hope this worked okay for you today. Such complicated talks. Thank you.